Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is off this week. Well, despite the continuing spread of COVID-19 throughout the state, Florida may soon allow visitors back into nursing homes and long-term care facilities. These sites have been hotbeds for the virus, and admission has been strictly controlled. But today, Governor Ron DeSantis announced the formation of a new task force on the safe and limited reopening of long-term care facilities in Florida. Now, DeSantis says the task force will develop guidelines on how to safely allow family members to visit loved ones. Visitation in facilities like these has been prohibited for months due to the pandemic. During a roundtable meeting Tuesday in Jacksonville, the governor said people would first have to show that they've already been infected with COVID-19 before they could visit their loved ones.
I would be comfortable saying, if you do have those COVID-19 antibodies, that you should be able to go in and see your family member. So we may work on that and may get moving on that.
Now, a task force is operating. Details about what they'll encourage and recommend are still pending. We're going to begin the hour here on the Florida Roundup with a closer look, and we want to know, do you have a loved one in a nursing home or a long-term care facility that you haven't been able to go visit? Maybe you work in one of these facilities. What are your thoughts about the limited reopening? Give us a call. It's 305-995-1800, wherever you are in the state, or tweet us at Florida Roundup. Marty Goetz is the CEO of River Garden Senior Services in Jacksonville. He's on the line. Hey, Marty, thanks for being with us. What's the current situation for visitors at River Garden? How are you handling this?
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me this afternoon. So we are 6 months into a prohibition of family visitation in a nursing home, and we've honored that executive order. At the same time, it's become increasingly more challenging maintaining that position. We've recently implemented porch visits with a plexiglass screen between residents and their loved ones. It's taken some of the pressure off, but the reality remains. We're social creatures, and we need each other to thrive.
Certainly, and that's clearly prompting this move, I would guess, from the governor to set up a task force to limit the reopening of facilities like River Garden. He says antibody testing would have to be done first. Is that something you'd be comfortable with?
Yes, I would be comfortable with that. And antigen testing equipment is in the process of being made available from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to every nursing home in the country. We received our equipment the end of last week, late last Friday. It will help. It will help. You know, I very much appreciate the governor's interest in making it possible for people to visit in the nursing homes. The truth of the matter is we need to be taking our lead from experts, not from the governor and not from Marty Goetz. It needs to be coming from the doctors. What's true, it needs to be coming from the Faucis and the Burke and those people who best understand this virus and how we might successfully manage the risk while we share responsibility.
I'm so glad you said that, Marty, we actually have someone in the queue right now to join you. It's Dr. Eileen Marty, an infectious disease specialist at FIU Medical School. And as we continue talking with Marty Goetz of River Garden, and Dr. Marty, we want your calls too. It's 305-995-1800. Dr. Marty, thanks for reappearing with us again and providing your insights here on the Florida Roundup. Good to have you on the show. And what are your thoughts about the governor's move today to start reopening nursing homes and long-term care facilities?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. And hello to Marty Goetz. Nice having you to chat with as well. And let me just let's start with some basic scientific facts so that then whatever I say about what the government is governor may or may not be suggesting makes more sense, if I may. Because I did notice that Marty spoke about the antigen tests coming. And then he, at the same breath, was talking about people having or not having antibodies. So it's really important that we make the distinction between an antigen and an antibody. An antigen is something that gen, see the gen word, that part of the word, generates. Antigens generate antibodies. So when you're looking for an antigen, you're not learning anything about antibodies per se. Understand? So when we do an antigen test, that means we're looking for these little proteins. They're little sugar-coated proteins that are integral parts of the virus. There's two antigen tests that have emergency authorization in the United States by the FDA, and these antigen tests look for a specific protein of the virus, and the one they're looking for in both the one that Becton Dickinson has out and the one that is from the Quidel Corporation, they're both looking for proteins that are these little helical proteins that are attached to the RNA of the virus. So they're looking at what are called nucleocapsid antigens. That's what an antigen test looks for. It has nothing to do with whether or not a person has or has not produce antibodies. That's a completely different test. The other test that's out there that everybody's looking at right now, and that's been the gold standard, are the tests that look for nucleic material. So that those are the RNA of the virus. That's that nasal pharyngeal swab that goes up there, and then we do reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction, RT-PCR, and we make bazillions. We make 40,000 copies of the original amount of virus that somebody has. It's really important to understand that there are three different things. Now, once you understand that, if you have antigen tests coming into your facility to test for whether or not somebody has antibodies, you're not going to find out anything.
Right. That's my question to you, Dr. Marty. Is this a safe reopening plan then, if this is how tests are apparently going to be administered?
Well, it's not about administering. It's about understanding what the test does. So if the antigen test is positive, it's probably true that the person currently has active infection with the SARS-2 virus and can share it with other people. If it's positive, although even a positive test using an antigen test can be fake. If the test is negative, the antigen test is negative, it doesn't mean squat. Because in both of the approved tests, you have to back that up because they're not sensitive enough. They don't make zillions of copies like you do when you do the RT-PCR tests. So a positive test probably means the person is currently infected. A negative test has to be backed up and doesn't mean the patient, person is safe to go in.
Then in your professional medical opinion, should there be other markers or protocols put into place before facilities reopen to visitors? What else would you recommend this task force enact to make this reopening safe for the patients, staff, and for the public?
So everything has to do with what is the level of risk that you're willing to have. And quite frankly, my personal opinion of how very dangerous this virus is to our elderly population, doing an antigen test at the door is not going to guarantee the safety of your elderly population. And I think it definitely still leaves people at risk because of the high false negative rates of these antigen tests.
All right. So then let me kick it back to Marty Goetz then quickly before we go to some callers. Hearing that, Marty, as the CEO of a senior facility in Jacksonville, what are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly agree with the physician. I agree with the doctor. The antigen test, and we just received the equipment for it, as I mentioned earlier, gives you an immediate answer. Now, it's not perfect, but the PCR test isn't perfect either. The PCR test is the gold standard. Testing is difficult throughout the country. It is certainly difficult in Florida. The reality is that we're 6 months into prohibition of families coming to visit loved ones. It is a real problem. It is a problem. It's a serious problem. I have to turn to the experts. I'm turning to the doctor. I'm turning to the scientists. These decisions need to come from people who best understand how we can manage risk and share responsibility.
Right. And let me just say that we do have calls waiting to connect with both of you as we talk about this new task force that's been set up by the governor to begin limited reopening of Florida's nursing homes and long-term care facilities. This will be done with antigen testing for people wanting entry. What do you think about this? Give us a call, everybody, across the state, 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. Seth is on the line in Broward County. Hi, Seth. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yeah, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
I'm an owner of a company called Dr. House Calls. We're a mobile physician group that serves patients throughout Palm Beach, Broward, and the Treasure Coast. The problem with the antibody test or antigen test, it actually doesn't really tell you much of anything. So if you're negative, that just means you haven't been exposed. If you're positive, yes, you've been exposed. However, at this time, no one knows how much of an immune you have or don't have. There's no one out there that says if you've been exposed and you have the immune antibody that you have X amount of time. We do not know how much time, and we go into people's homes. So we're dealing with this every day. So it's a very, very false thing for the governor to say, let people go in and get tested for the antibody or antigen, because we don't know if there is an immune reaction and even how long that lasts. So that's putting people's lives at risk. Very, 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 very bad.
All right, Seth, thanks. Yeah, and I hear the anxiety in your voice as a business operator dealing with this at close range. Dr. Marty, he's echoing some of your really insightful comments about the types of tests that are available and what they do and do not tell us. And so, go ahead.
I failed miserably to explain that there's a huge difference between an antigen test and an antibody test. An antigen test looks for actual virus, looks for protein of the virus. An antibody test is a human reaction or a host reaction to the presence of an antigen. Very, very different tests. Please do not confuse them.
And you think he was conflating those two. Okay.
Please, everybody keeps confusing an antigen test and an antibody test. What Seth is talking about is really pertinent to the antibody tests. Antibody tests are about a person's reaction. And he's right. A lot of people, first of all, a fair number of people don't even develop antibodies who've been exposed. Others who do can lose those antibodies after only a couple of months, whether or not they had symptoms. So that's a problematic test in and of itself, the antibody test. The antigen tests, which are tests for the protein, the sugar-coated protein of the virus, are not sensitive enough. And that's why those tests are different. And even though they're valuable, they are valuable as part of a strategy. If you take an antigen test and it's positive, you are probably positive for SARS-CoV-2. If you take an antigen test and it is negative, you need a backup test, and the FDA's EUAs, emergency authorizations, state very clearly that you have to back up the antigen test with a molecular test.
Understood.
If you do not.
And let me, if I could, Doctor, just simply because there are so many folks waiting to tell their stories, let's go on the line now to Richard in Sarasota. Richard, you're calling from an independent living facility. Go ahead.
That is correct. I live at the Aviva Retirement Complex in Sarasota. I live in the Kobernik Pavilion, which is the pavilion for independent living. And the reason I'm here is my wife is an assisted living in the next pavilion on the campus, which is called the Anshin Pavilion. And she's in assisted living. I can't see her except through a window.
And that's I'm sure that's just been terrible for you. So what do you think about this potential change in policy then?
Well, the policy sounds good, but it's quite dangerous. It would appear to me that if at minimum we could have that type of rapid testing that the president seems to enjoy, and I don't know who else enjoys it. I understand that it's all over. According to the Houston Chronicle, they have it all over the place in Harris County and in Houston. Even the physicians have these rapid tests. It would be awful nice if there would at least be the precaution of one of these rapid tests so that they could test me and I could visit my wife if
right.
I'm negative. And people could visit me if they tested negative. One of the problems that's facing Aviva, as I understand it from the management, is what are the costs of these tests? Nobody seems to be able to supply a cost number.
Let's discuss that. And Richard, I want to thank you for your call, and I'm so sorry you and your wife are in this situation. Marty Goetz, so what we've been able to glean from this discussion is, as you pointed out, seniors in facilities like yours are really suffering in this isolation. But as we've learned from Dr. Marty, there are certainly limitations to the testing that is currently available, and the public doesn't really understand the difference between the tests. We don't know the cost of the tests, as he pointed out. This puts facilities in a tough spot, I would think, and you've got to weigh the social isolation against the continuing risk of disease. A very difficult challenge right now for you, sir.
We are, as I said earlier, we are managing risk and sharing responsibility. By the way, I know the community, Richard, with that, even it's excellent. It's just a wonderful community in the west coast of Florida. That is the case. You know, as I said earlier, we just started porch visits. We've actually been doing them for about a week now. So we're not in violation of the governor's order. They are scheduled. Up to two members of a family can come, and it's the equivalent of looking through the glass, only they're outside, and I've got a plexiglass between the parties with some supervision. The reality is, from the very beginning of these orders, going back now almost 6 months, there has been provision for compassionate visitation. We have had instances where family members have come in to see a family member within my nursing home. I need a physician's order for it. We put them into proper PPE, and they visit. And we've not had any difficulties with it. It's just rarely done because we're not looking to abuse that privilege.
You abuse that privilege.
Marty, I wish we could keep going, but we're out of time.
We're out of time. I want to thank you both so much. Marty Goetz, CEO of River Garden Senior Services in Jacksonville. Dr. Eileen Marty, specialist on infectious diseases at FIU. Thank you both. Up next, we're going to speak with the only caregiver named to the new task force by the governor, plus a conversation with Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood on his battle with coronavirus here on the Florida Roundup. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, Jacksonville resident Mary Daniel recently received national attention when she became a dishwasher at a memory care facility in her area. Now, she did this because it allows her to see her husband, who's a resident there. Family visits, of course, have been restricted in the pandemic. Mary is now the only caregiver on the governor's new statewide task force for safely reopening long-term care facilities to loved ones. Mary Daniel is on the line. Mary, good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you. What did you communicate to Governor DeSantis about your experience with your husband and your separation from him that made him tap you for this task force?
I think he saw that I was incredibly persistent in trying to get his attention to express to him one-on-one what it's like from the caregiver's perspective and from the actual patient's perspective. It is a heartbreaking story. And when you hear of those stories that are being told over and over and over by hundreds of thousands of people, not only in Florida, but across the United States, it can't help but open your eyes and open your heart to say, we can do better than this. Let's see what that looks like.
Right. And of course, you've been separated from your husband for months now due to the pandemic. So you went so far as to get a job washing dishes at the facility where he lives. What have the last several months been like for you and your husband?
I have been incredibly fortunate. I saw him last night. I worked last night. I worked Thursdays and Fridays, so I will get to go back and see him again this evening. I will work a couple hours, actually 2 hours in the kitchen, cleaning up the dinner dishes and getting the kitchen ready for the next day. And then I get to go be with him. And we've fallen into the very same routine that we had every day before the lockdown. I went to see him in the evenings after work every single day, got him ready for bed. And we settled in, watched television together until he drifted off to sleep. So We have been able to do that. And the peace that comes with that, not only for me, but especially for him, knowing that I'm there, knowing that he hasn't been abandoned, knowing that he's not alone, I mean, that is incredibly priceless. And I'm going to work very hard to see if I can't get that back for all the caregivers and their loved ones.
I'm sure your husband has benefited so much from your devotion. You know, it reminds me so much of the book and the movie The Notebook. You guys are a real-life version of that. Okay, so what do you think then about the task force that's been established to start reopening facilities so that loved ones don't have to do what you did? They don't have to go get a job as a dishwasher to see their spouse or their child or their parent. What do you think should be done so that these reopenings can be done safely?
Well, let me start by saying that I absolutely believe all of this was done with the right intentions. And by all means, we really didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. In many ways, we still don't with this virus. But we have isolated these patients because we wanted to save them. And what is happening now, 5 months later, is the isolation is killing them. So what I am going to offer is the common sense, safe, step-by-step compromise. We're not asking for the doors to be just, opened up wide and we all come in. We do know that there need to be restrictions. This needs to be done safely. That's why we, as a Facebook group, we have a Facebook group called Caregivers for Compromise. We know we'll need to compromise. We know that this will need to be a step-by-step process, but we're ready to see those steps. And right now we have spent the last 5 months in the dark and we have been heartbroken and saddened and grieving and helpless and hopeless, and it's time for that to end. We need to know what this path looks like. We've been extremely patient for 5 months, but we are losing our loved ones. There are posts every single day on our Facebook page of "It's too late. I lost my mother today, and she died alone."
And we have a call about that, Mary, from Jacksonville. Kathleen in Jacksonville lost her sister at a nursing home. Hi, Kathleen. Tell us quickly what happened in your family, if you could.
My sister tested positive. Well, she's been in a nursing home, and I had been visiting her. I drive from Jacksonville to Live Oak every other week, and I was like the highlight of her life, because she didn't have anybody else around here. And then she got positive for COVID, so I'd come out and see her through the window. But then she got to where they moved her, and I couldn't see her. And then she got real sick, and she kept getting sick and then well and then sick and then well. And by the time that they said, well, you can come say goodbye, she was already unconscious and wouldn't even known I was there, and she passed.
I'm so sorry, Kathleen. It just breaks my heart that you had to lose your sister this way and that you couldn't say goodbye. Kathleen, thank you for your call. Mary, this is the heartbreak that so many families are going through. And as you said, You have a Facebook group for families in this situation. Can let us know how people can join this group.
The group is called Caregivers for Compromise, because isolation kills too. We have a national group that has about 7,300 members, and then we have a group for every single state. So, for example, in Florida, it says Florida Caregivers for Compromise, because we want everyone in each state to be able to organize among themselves, do what we're doing in Florida, and we're providing roadmaps. We provide white papers. We're providing information so that people can follow our lead in other states to get the attention of their governor and their government so that they can do exactly the same thing. We have sat back and have been quiet, and part of the frustration is truly the helplessness and the hopelessness. And we're trying to engage other caregivers just like me. I'm no different than anybody else. I just spoke very loudly. And finally, our love story, interestingly enough, it's a feel-good story, and people love it. And I mean, we're even in People magazine today, because it's just something in this, especially in these times, people need a feel-good story. But the beautiful part about this story to me is it's opened the door for us to tell the not-so-pretty story. And that is that people just like the story we heard are dying every single day, and they're dying alone. And we can do better than that. There just has to be a better way.
Well, Mary, I thank you so much for joining us. It really is great to get your story out to all the listeners across the state. And again, Mary is on the new task force for reopening long-term care facilities. Best to you and your husband, Mary. Thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it. Well, several people who have tested positive for coronavirus were at a recent event also attended by the governor. Now, this happened at a two-day meeting of the Florida Sheriff's Association on July 27th and 28th in Bonita Springs. Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood was one of those who tested positive. Earlier today, I spoke with Chitwood about his bout with coronavirus. Let's listen. Sheriff Chitwood, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And it's good to hear that you're on the mend after testing positive for the coronavirus last week. But I understand you've had a tough time with it. What have your symptoms been like? What's the disease process been like for you?
Yeah, this is not been a joke. This is the sickest I've ever been in my life. 33 years of policing, I've never used a sick day. Even if I was not in quarantine, I'd be unable to go to work. Last Thursday when I got up, I felt fantastic. I got up, I worked out. Around lunchtime, I felt like there was something stuck in my throat and I couldn't clear it. And I drank a lot of water, got home from work around 6:30, went to go take another bike ride, and I just felt horrible. And I got home, I showered, and about an hour later, I had a really high temperature. It was over 102, and it stayed that way all night. Thursday night into Friday morning. Friday morning, I got up, I tried to work out again, and it just wasn't happening. I was just completely wiped out. So I figured at the time we had a tropical storm coming our way, and I was going to be in the emergency operations center all weekend. So I figured, you know, now's the time to go and get tested. And sure enough, go in, urgent care, get a rapid test done, and doctor comes in and says, I got good news and bad news for you. Good news is, me and my husband love you in the sheriff's office. Bad news is, you have coronavirus.
And this shows you how, you get the idea of how quickly someone can come down with it and how rapidly the symptoms can get really serious. Now,
yeah, it's no joke. I mean, it is highly contagious.
The virus at this conference I mentioned, because you and a number of other officials have since tested positive and you were in the same room as the governor, which has caused some concern. Do you think that's where you got it?
You know, you can't say conclusively, but, you know, being a cop, I would say is pretty darn a good guess, a good educated guess that that's somehow where I contracted it. But what was strange was, you know, you had to wear a mask in the common areas, in the ballroom that probably you could put 250 or 300 people. There were only maybe 45 of us. So it was social distancing on steroids. And I didn't eat in the hotel. I didn't socialize with anybody. You know, I went to the conference. I sat in the class. When class was over, I got out on my bike. I went to Publix and got a sandwich and went back to my room. So I was not in contact with anybody that was sick, nor did I shake hands with anybody.
But it's still possible that just the floating droplets, even with masks and social distancing, with people, a few dozen people under a roof, could have spread the disease. I mean, this is what public health experts keep warning us about. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I agree. Like I said, I'm not the greatest at wearing a mask, but, you know, I really, really try to social distance. I really keep my hands clean. I really try to do all the things you're supposed to do. I just think that this thing is so, this COVID-19 is so transmittable. It's easy to catch that no matter what you do to protect yourself, there's still a chance you're going to get it.
Absolutely. Now, you are a sheriff and a visible one in Florida. You've been vocal about how the state is dealing with the pandemic, along with the ongoing conversation we're having in this country about police reform. How are you managing these twin huge movements and stories that all of us are really dialed in on right now? How is that affecting policing in your county?
Well, first and foremost, the objective is to protect my workforce from the coronavirus. You know, there is no such thing as social distancing in policing. We still have to go hands-on and make arrests. We still have to deal with the community. And we are a 911 call center for the county. We do all three disciplines, police, fire, and EMS. So I have to make sure that those folks, give them all the tools possible to stay as healthy as possible so that they can do their job. And then out of that flows the other issues with the social unrest, the mistrust of police, and de-escalation. So to say that these are trying times is an understatement, but I also have learned that if you surround yourself with really good people, it's in times like this that the talent and the passion for what they do shines through.
What is your hope for both how we deal with public health and also how we deal with policing coming out of this pandemic? What types of changes do you think will come out of this really challenging time we're experiencing right now?
I know I'm being a bit utopian when I say this, but the removal of politics from the virus and from what we're seeing is essential to be successful. On the pandemic side, get politics out of it. Let's follow the best science. Let's follow the best practices. Let's see what's going on around the world and the things that work. Use those. The things that don't work, scrap them. Build on successful concepts. Eliminate weak ones. The same thing applies with what's going on with the social unrest. Let's everybody put your political bias aside. Let's all sit down at the table, get out your prejudices, get out your opinions, air them out, clear them, put them away in a box, and let's charge forward. This is an American problem that's going to call for American solutions across the spectrum. It's the only way we're going to make this thing better.
Is that what you tell your officers, and how do they respond to that?
I think for the most part, the officers and my deputies get it. For the most part, they understand that we in American policing have to change. We have to change from a warrior mindset to a guardian mindset. It's not what we want. It's what the people we serve want. Now, you're always going to have that old guard, that good old boy, that the whole world is wrong and we're right. And that's what got us in this position, because people refuse to change and realize that the way you did things in 1970 isn't the way you do things in 2020 anymore.
And getting back to COVID, it's interesting to note that at this event you attended with the governor, the Florida Corrections Secretary, Deputy Corrections Secretary, the Gilchrist County Sheriff, they've all tested positive too for COVID. I read that you were treated with a Z-Pack, a good old-fashioned Z-Pack, some vitamin C and zinc, all over-the-counter stuff for the most part. You were never hospitalized, I don't believe. Even knowing that, you've still had a pretty serious bout with this disease, Sheriff Chitwood. So what would you say to those out there listening who don't think this is a serious public health problem? They're not worried about protecting against the virus, or some of them think it's a hoax.
Yeah, and that is frustrating to think that people think this is a hoax. I have never been this sick this long in my entire life. The intensity of the headaches and the nausea and the body aches, it was debilitating. Like I said, even if I wasn't in quarantine, there was no way that I could get off the floor or the couch to go to work. I just couldn't do it. And to folks out, and I have no underlying health conditions. I take no medication. I can't imagine how somebody with underlying health conditions would battle this, because you're just so weak and so sick. My advice is really simple. I think one of the reasons that, I mean, my good health played into the fact that it didn't get into my lungs, but also the doctor had said, you know, the first day I felt symptoms, well, obviously I felt symptoms on Thursday night, but Friday morning I was in there getting tested. The doctor said that, you know, if you wait too long, if you waited 5 days or 7 days and said, you know, I need to go and get tested, by then the disease has, you know, it's going on unchecked for that time period, and it would have definitely got into your lungs, and now you're dealing with a different animal. So my advice is go to your primary care physician, go to urgent care. The minute you don't feel good, go get tested,
15.
And then deal with it from there.
Good advice, and good to hear you're doing better. And I want to thank you for your thoughts here on the Florida Roundup, Sheriff. Thanks so much. This is Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. You guys have a great weekend.
And up next, the presidential race, Florida, and voting by mail. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is off this week. Well, early voting is underway across the state for the upcoming primary election on August 18th. And there's been a big increase this cycle in the number of Florida voters who have registered to vote by mail, especially for the fall election in November. Voters say they plan on doing that. Now, President Trump has made a series of conflicting and false statements about vote by mail in recent weeks. First, he tweeted that vote by mail is not reliable or even a scam. But then he reversed himself and said vote by mail is a good thing to do, but only in certain places like Florida. How is this affecting voter turnout and voter habits? Mark Caputo covers Florida for Politico, and he's on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Good to have you on the show. And Florida, give us a call. Let us know your thoughts about vote by mail. It's 305-995-1800. What's turnout been like for the early voting in the primary so far, Mark?
Well, so far it's been pretty heavily absentee ballot focused, but then again, that makes sense because this is the period where absentee ballots are, coming in. What's interesting, though, is that in both requests and in returns, Republicans are not performing the way they used to. I think, this is just a guess, that the president's harsh, conflicting, unclear, and in some cases false rhetoric about voting by mail has depressed voting by mail turnout among his own base. And you see that in Florida. And so, for instance, normally Republicans dominate voting by mail. They have a higher return rate, and they usually return more vote by mail, or as I used to call them, and as we used to call them, absentee
ballot. Sure.
Right now, you're not seeing that. You're now seeing Democrats have returned 183,000 more ballots than Republicans by mail. In requests, it's even bigger. There's a 450,000 edge in requests for absentee ballots or vote by mail ballots.
Well, that's a big difference. And certainly, as you point out, the GOP has perfected the art of getting their voter base to vote absentee over the past 20 years. What are your thoughts on some reporting we've seen that they've told the president to cool it on trying to discredit voting by mail or absentee balloting?
Well, after that reporting came out, the president started to kind of change his tune, saying, hey, Florida, things are great. You know, keep on doing it.
Right.
The fundamental problem is this, is that the president has made a number of false statements, inaccurate statements, unclear statements about voting by mail. And what he meant to ultimately do, as his handlers have now started to perfect to understand what he meant to say, or what they say he meant to say, was that he opposes universal voting by mail where people don't request the absentee ballot, or pardon me, the vote by mail ballot. That's what the president opposes, they say. This is now their story. What he doesn't oppose is a system, such as in Florida, where the voter, who's already registered, requests his or her ballot and goes through that step to get it. That is basically, he's opposed to automatically everyone being mailed a ballot versus what he supports, which is that individual voters request the ballots and then get them, that he supports.
We're speaking with Mark Caputo of Politico about Florida's always being an important factor in presidential races. Let me ask you, Mark, as well, that former Vice President Joe Biden is expected to announce his pick for his running mate for vice president any day now. Florida politics are factoring into this. The front runner, the safe choice is seen by many as Kamala Harris. Karen Bass of California, her name has come up, although she may or may not make it now, given some comments she recently made that were unearthed about Fidel Castro. So how do you see Florida politics factoring into Biden's choice?
Well, it's interesting you forgot to mention Val Demings, who's an Orlando congressman.
And Val Demings, of course, in Orlando. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's probably the first stop in when we talk about Florida and the Veep stakes. It's Val Demings. Is she going to make it or is she not? You know, the way you framed your question is a good example of like how, kind of how most of us view this, which is that we don't think Val is in the top tier. Also don't think Karen Bass is in the top tier. The conventional wisdom is that it's either California Senator Kamala Harris or former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, who would be a really interesting pick because I don't think she's even run for dog catcher. She might be the first one in modern times who, if Susan Rice picked, would never have held any elected office or run for one and become vice president. But Rice served for 8 years in the Obama administration. She's intimately familiar with Washington. Joe Biden is a Washington creature and loves Washington institutions, so to speak. And so that is why, you know, she is being whispered about or rumored about. But the reality is that this is now in Joe Biden's hands. And he's not telling people who he's picked. Now, he might not have made up his own mind. So almost everything you read right now is kind of like Plato's allegory of the man in the cave, where people are kind of reading the shadows cast by firelight. So beware of people saying they definitely know who it is. A lot of that is educated guessing and in some cases kind of unethical reporting.
Yeah, we won't know till the announcement comes. Calls, meanwhile, for you about voting by mail versus voting in person. Lance is in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Lance. How are you going to cast your ballot?
Well, I think I'm going to vote in person. I had wanted to vote by mail, but to be honest, I'm a little nervous about whether or not that vote will even be counted. I feel like voting in person kind of ensures that maybe my vote actually gets counted.
All right, Lance, thanks. Mark Caputo. What about that? It's interesting to note that the changing attitudes about voting by mail. What about that?
Well, I can't disagree with them. I've always voted early since 2002, once they implemented. And there are problems with casting your absentee ballot by mail. If your signature doesn't match, you got to sign the envelope. If you don't do that, your ballot's going to get rejected. If your signature doesn't match the one on file, it could get rejected. So those are two steps. And then there's the thing like, is the Postal Service going to deliver your absentee ballot on time? Because understand, it's not a postmark issue in Florida. Your ballot has to be received by the supervisor of election in your county by 7 p.m. on election day. So those are three extra little things there that could be a snafu, whereas if you go to the polling precinct and you bubble in who you're going to choose and you feed into the machine, you have a much more reasonable expectation that it's, your ballot's going to be counted and counted accurately.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we continue our conversation with Mark Caputo of Politico, Mark, I want to ask you about a new report today in the Palm Beach Post. It shows that the DeSantis administration told school boards across Florida that they would need health department approval if they wanted to keep their classrooms closed. Then they instructed health directors not to give that approval. Critics of the governor have said that he's making these kinds of moves so as not to get crosswise with President Trump, who has called for all schools to be opened. This report is just being published, and it's already generating a lot of outrage. Your thoughts?
Well, it should generate outrage if it's true, and I think there's probably some truth to it. Now, there is no smoking gun document that I saw where the health department was told by the Department of Health, or the county health departments were told by the state surgeon general, hey, approve nobody. But this is what happens in systems, big systems, where this is what can happen, where the mid-level bureaucrats think that this is what the guy at the top really wants, and therefore they adjust the system accordingly, right? It's kind of the same way that herd animals kind of suddenly magically move, but in reality they're just reading subtle body language and cues. So do we have a smoking gun document? No. Is Ron DeSantis doing this just to make Trump happy? I think there's an element of that, again, assuming this is happening. But also understand this, DeSantis has been very consistent in the way in which he's viewed coronavirus, which is that he has not been as attuned to expert opinion, scientific opinion, the opinions of epidemiologists. And he kind of independently thought, hey, this is going to go away. Hey, Florida is not going to be so bad. And he has led a system which has reacted accordingly. So I don't want to get reading too much into DeSantis's mind, but I think that he and Trump are on the same wavelength anyway. So it's not just like, oh, DeSantis didn't believe this stuff and wanted to flee the president. No, this is kind of his general mindset and his worldview. The problem that DeSantis has had is that while the state was doing quite well for quite some time, once we started to go to phase two opening on June 5th, that's when we started to see cases explode, positivity rate explode. And then following that, even though the governor was trying to assure everyone that things weren't so bad because of various demographic reasons, we then started to see hospitalizations increase and then death hit record numbers.
And the governor's approval ratings plummet as a consequence of that.
Yeah.
And
right. It's been mystifying to watch because DeSantis, despite what you'll hear from partisans, is a smart guy. I'm not saying just because you go to Harvard you're smart, but he is a Harvard and Yale grad. And he does have a command of the data and the numbers. But his interpretation of the data and the numbers has been kind of surprising, especially when lots of studies show and anecdotal information indicate as well, and experts will tell you, epidemiologists will warn you, wear masks. And a statewide mask mandate actually helps reduce transmission and increase compliance. He steadfastly refused to do that. It's never been clear exactly as to why he thought that was an intelligent idea.
Right. Still no statewide mandate, although most major cities around Florida at least now have it. Always good to get your insights. Mark Caputo covering this crazy state of Florida for Politico. Thanks, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Denise Royal and Heather Schatz are producers. Jason Zabka is WLRN's Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Mertz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. And our theme music comes to you courtesy of Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend and keep wearing your masks, Florida. We'll be back next Friday at noon.